that Franz will be discussing next week, where he's going to be mainly concentrating on the gravity side of things. The sources are not going to be incorporated, but for the most part. And the reason for that is what we discussed on Tuesday, where all these sources couple through lower order terms, therefore they do not affect the characteristic problem, and therefore you can worry about how to do the gravity side on one end, the hydrodynamics or the sources on another end, and then lately you bring everything together. So before actually I tell you a little bit of the new material, which as I said, we're not going to cover all this, but I want you to have it as a reference. We wanted to make sure we actually gave some examples of how these different techniques that we've been discussing actually behave in a particular solution. These are things that you have to do in your, for your homework, but we really wanted to stress this part. Let me just go back to the Burgers equation. And again, I keep going there because the Burgers equations have all the peculiarities we have to deal with when we talk about the full hydrodynamic problems in general relativity. And we're going to compare the solutions for four different discretizations. So again, we're thinking about this equation. Which we think we can use the chain rule and take partial derivatives to write it in this way. But as we argue, this might not give you the correct solution because Q need not at all be a continuous or a smooth function. We will see how this actually comes into play when you actually do an implementation, whether at this level or at that level. So we're going to recognize four different ways of doing this equation. So the first one is just taking it from this end, where we actually take a derivative, we write it that way. And we're going to use this stencil that I mentioned the other day, where we're going to assume that Q is positive. So things propagate in the right direction. So we're going to use a stencil that looks like this. So at the I point, we're involving these points to take the time derivative and this four points to take the special derivative. And what we have to be careful with is, remember this criteria, that things will be stable if the numerical domain of dependence contains the analytical domain of dependence. So notice I'm updating the value of the field at the ith point in the n plus 1 level by using things to the left. That's only going to be stable if things propagate from left to right. If things were propagating from right to left, which would be the case if Q were negative, then we would have to flip these things and use the points on the other side. So be careful that if you are doing this problem and you choose values for Qs that are negative, these schemes that we're discussing here will be utterly unstable. So you're going to have to deal with that. So we're going to be assuming that all Qs we give as initial data are positive. But it's just an illustration. So the first one will be that, where we use this approach or this way of writing the equations, and we just use a second order approximation in time because we're evaluating things in the middle, but we use a first order approximation because you can very easily see with the techniques that were discussed by Choptek last week that this approximation is just a first order approximation to the derivative function at this point. The second option we're going to adopt is this one, where we approach the problem from this point of view, where we keep this flux together as its own entity, and we just take the derivative, again, using the same recipe. And here I argued last class that if you just use the polynomial identity and rewrite this in this particular way, you could recognize this one as a, with the delta x as a spatial derivative. And this one you can recognize it as the velocity of the flow. And this one, you'll see, will get the shock speed right. Will not be very accurate, but it will get the shock speed right. And the third one is where we're going to see how this behaves in these two cases. We're going to perhaps argue that maybe we're not doing the most accurate possible job. So we're going to rewrite the spatial derivative, not in that way, but in this way, which you can, again, prove that it is a second-order approximation now to the spatial derivative of the value of the grid function Q squared, at this point. And this is just a very simple exercise.
Is this the same as the forward derivative that we did?
Yep, it's exactly the same one. And as last, so yes.
Let's assume this is, yeah, it should be I minus 2 on one of those terms.
Yes, sorry, this is I minus 2. Sorry about that.
And above that, there should be a 2 in the denominator.
Where? The yes, this one too.
That 2 should be,
yeah, should be there as well. Sorry, in the notes it's correct. This I was typing it this morning in a hurry. And the fourth option would be this Godunov method that will try to capture what the fluid is actually doing. Remember what Matt was discussing last week. Whenever you approach a problem, make sure you try to put in a single page all the information that you're trying to do. So here is will be the information of what is the technique that we're going to be using to upgrade or to update the value of function Q. We need to specify what the boundary conditions are. And the simplest boundary conditions for doing hydrodynamics, which are not very accurate, but remember what we're thinking about is that we always do whatever job needs to be done so that we push the boundaries really farther, as far as possible, so that whatever we do at the boundary is not influencing the physics that we're trying to understand. This, of course, depending on the situation, might not be something that you can always do. If you're thinking about, say, doing something in ADS, the boundary is part of your physics. You better do it correctly. So this approach would not be sensible there. But for astrophysical kind of experiments, this is just fine. So what we do is you iterate using these rules from the third to the nx minus 2 point. And then at the last 2 points, you simply copy the values at the point 1 and 2 to whatever you had at the point third point, and similarly for points nx and x minus 1. What this one is doing is if a flow is going towards the boundary, in the last 2 points, you just propagate it that way. You just say it's just going in the same way. And if at the other boundary, you're just saying whatever made that flow go in that direction, we just keep feeding it. So we're continuously feeding some material to keep these conditions being satisfied. And this is just a stable boundary condition. For initial data, we're going to be discussing two. The shock tube problem, this is the problem where we discuss the Riemann problem. We discuss the exact solution to that problem. And let me just show you the phenomenology of this problem and compare to how each of these methods do. And something we're going to take another data, which is just a Gaussian profile, very much like the one you've been playing with for the other homework. And there is a generic analytical understanding of where the shocks, the time of the shock will be that arises. And you can prove rigorously, but we're not going to get into it, that it's given by the inverse of the minimum of the gradient of the function. So if this Q were a constant function, then these shocks wouldn't appear because you don't have different pieces of the fluid propagated at different velocity. If everything is propagated at exactly the same velocity, nothing happened. But as soon as you have a gradient, then you're going to have regions where the local velocity of the flow will be different at neighboring points, and therefore they either will cross or they will open up in a fan. So let me just go through some of the examples so that you see how this time that we have spent in all these problems actually is relevant. So this is the Riemann shock problem, or Riemann cube problem, or the shock tube problems, where we give us left data is 1, and that's right data 0.1. So this is the example. It's positive. Everything is going to be moving to the right. This side of the flow will be propagated much faster than this other side of the flow. So this one catches up to that one. And remember, we're going to generate the shock fronts that propagate at a speed that is given by the average of these two. So this is the exact solution. This is the one we wrote down on Tuesday. Let me just play it simply to have that as a reference. So here you see that solution. Remember, we had the left boundary propagating at the speed of the shock, and the right side just simply moving to the right as well at the right speed. And the velocity that this shock front has is the average of this and that value. OK, now let me show you what happens when you do that problem with this rho solver that we have been discussing so far. And on blue you have the exact solution that we had. Now, on red, you have the exact solution that we had. And on blue is our solution, numerical solution. As you can see, it's tracking it very nicely. There's a slight difference here, but for the most part, we neither have oscillations, spurious oscillations at the interface, nor we have the wrong shock speed. Remember the second part of the second alternative we had for the Riemann problem, which was the left being smaller than the right. So this one is going to be propagating to the right much faster than this one. So it's going to open up this fan. And again, this, the analytical solution is given by this. Here you see this fan open up, opening it up. And that's the correct solution. Remember, we argue that you have to go through this weak analysis of the equation, impose the entropy conditions to single out a unique solution, and this is just behavior. So let's look at now the same thing, but now done with the row solver. And again, you see again, our numerical solution, which is given by the red, by the blue, is following the analytical solution given by the red pretty well. There is some slight difference, but you can see that this will converge. So with the more points we have, the better job we're going to be doing. OK, so this is how things would look like. Now let us discuss the R problem in front of a Gaussian. And let's just try to compare what this naive or not, perhaps not so naive, discretization would give us. So the first one is we're going to be comparing what we obtained using the row solver, which with this one done in this first order accurate way. We're going to have a shock again because we have regions that would propagate at different speeds. So for instance, this region will be propagating at this speed, but this region will be propagating at a faster speed. So we're going to have on this end a shock. On this other end, this region propagates faster than that one. So we're going to be opening up a fan over there. And notice how very quickly we get a completely wrong solution. This is the solution that the row gives you. We get a really bad shock propagation. We have our amplitude is completely gone. We're half what we should have. This part is done correctly, but we completely get it wrong on this R. So this is the algorithm where we're using sideways upwind derivative, sideways derivative for the value q to take derivatives. The time derivative is in between these two levels, but we're writing the function in this way. And we discuss on Monday and Tuesday what's wrong with this. When we did this, we took this step. But this step is only justified if the solution is smooth. So when you take the chain rule here, or the Leibniz rule, we're implicitly assuming that things are smooth enough that we are justified in taking this step. So now we're going to do the same. We're going to look at this level, where we just keep the flux in its own form. And we'll just use first a sideways derivative, and then a higher order sideways derivative as well. So it's the same thing, but now we're writing things in the flux form. So now we get the right speed, and we have some slight difference here and there. It's not too bad. Actually, it's pretty decent for this simple problem. But we may say, well, maybe we're not getting a more accurate solution because our approximation is just only first order accurate. Let's try to introduce a second order approximation to the derivative. So now I'm going to involve this R point here to have a second order derivative at that point and see how it behaves. So now we have something that's much more accurate here, but we have this extra oscillation. And we have this noise there, which is what we work hard for with this slope limiter condition to make sure we don't end up with this one. So we don't try to be more accurate than we can in regions where a discontinuity might arise. So this is just, again, what the row solution would give you. And you can see how very few points actually go through these huge gradients. Here you have 1 and 2 points, and the code just simply works fine. And this is the same thing with just points. So anyway, so this is the kind of behavior that you should see in your homework, the very first warm-up exercise of that homework number 2 or lab number 2 is to play around with this. And you can change, vary the values of the profiles, both for the Gaussian and the shock tube problem, and just look at the phenomenology. And remember one thing, so you could use XVS to just compute where this cut is happening, how fast the shock is propagating. You know, you have an analytic solution of how fast the shock would be propagating for the Riemann tube problem. Just make sure that you check that you're actually doing the right job when you use the row solver. I think, yeah. Okay, so that's, any questions about this? So today we're gonna have the tutorial, and tomorrow as well we're gonna press hard on the tutorial just to get you guys going. Remember we said that from here to the ultra-relativistic hydrodynamic problem that you have actually to work with, there is a significant work that needs to be done. So make sure you ask us all the questions you need. Yes?
So we've seen how this naive sort of way of formulating the problem gives you incorrect results using the Gaussian when you apply it to Gaussian. So why did it work when we applied it to the first paper?
It worked? Well, let's see. You're saying, so work is probably this one?
No, for like the step.
Oh, okay. Well, we haven't used it for here. No, for this one, we always had the raw solution versus the exact solution that we know.
Okay.
If we had used it, we would have exactly the same things. We would have, if we had used not in this form, but that form, and you would do first order accurate, we would get the shock propagation right. There would be some inaccuracy, but our approximation to what the solution is doing here, far from the shock, would still be first order accurate, while the raw will give you second order accuracy here. And again, this is a very simple problem where we were able to play around with the right-hand side to at least get the right velocity of propagation correctly. But in general, the situation is much worse. So.
What would the very crude approximation give for a shock?
For this one?
Yeah.
So you'll get the shock completely wrong, the shock speed completely. Well, it just propagates at the wrong speed. So rather, so if we look at this case, let's see. Let me just, this one, which is simpler. Oops. Yeah. So here, this is a value of 1, and this is a value of 0.1 in this case. The velocity of propagation would be 1 plus 0.1 is 1.1 divided by 2 is 0.55. So the shock should be moving at 0.55 in whatever units you use. If you don't use a 1, it's going to be moving at 1. Because if this one keeps moving, I'm using this one to know how to move to the right. I'm going to keep evaluating that point, which is still 1, and it just moves at double the velocity.
So what happens if you're, you know, sort of crazy enough to use the stuff you would try for smooth stuff, you know, like center differences and variable and you get a bunch of, you know, wiggles all over the place or something?
Right, so if you use it without any extra dissipation to try to clean up those wiggles, then you're going to get perhaps the right, we actually saw an example of this, let me just go back to it. You're going to get perhaps the right propagation, but you're going to have all these extra oscillations, which we saw in this case, which then you're going to say, okay, I need to fix that. So all this is going to be feeding extra energy, if you want, at the front of the shock, which might have its impact. So then you say, okay, I'm going to clean it out. I'm going to just put a filter. But now you have to be careful, because if I put a filter everywhere, I'm going to be touching things that I shouldn't be. So the old school or the old way of treating these problems was to actually use artificial dissipation with a factor in front that actually was trying to keep track of where you should do it. And so it was a function that was zero here and here. Depending if things varied a lot, then you would put it by hand.
Disgusting.
Yeah. That was the best it could be done there. So I wouldn't fight with them, because these more robust techniques hadn't been developed. But then you had to deal with this problem. And in fact, these row solvers that we discussed that evaluate the flux from the left and evaluate the flux from the right, and they use the characteristic structure to know how things are moving and compare what is going on in one end and the other one, it's implicitly adding the right amount of dissipation to control this. But it only does it here, because you always keep track of what is the jump between one cell and the next one. And if it is smooth, then you don't do anything. OK. So any other question? No? OK, let me jump. So let me just stress again. Make sure you try the homework and you get going as soon as possible, because then next week, Franz Pretorius, who is sitting at the back of the room, will be kicking up things with gravity. And actually, today and tomorrow, the three of us will be around. So all the instructors of the numerical relativity section are together. Yeah, let me pick this up. Okay, so let me just do one very simple application, and then we'll look at the more general case. The first one is, whenever you have a pretty complicated set of equations, it's always good at least to see if you can get solutions by assuming as many symmetries as you can. That will give you at least some intuition of what the type of solutions might be, and then you can study perturbations on top of that, and usually it also gives you a pretty setup to compare your solutions with respect to in the particular scenario where that symmetries are satisfied. So we're going to look at the special case of spherically symmetric static stars. So from our discussions yesterday, we're going to express a stress energy tensor describing some fluid by the ideal, the perfect fluid condition, or the perfect fluid stress energy tensor this way, where now I introduce a new function that will be handy for what we discuss later. It's called the specific enthalpy, which is just given by 1 plus internal energy, which we introduced yesterday, plus p divided by rho. So if I replace this in here, I will just have rho plus rho times epsilon plus p, which is what we wrote yesterday. And we yesterday took a particular limit where the rho was much smaller than rho times epsilon. So we just picked a single variable.
Is that a rho or a rho zero?
Well, some people, it depends. People write it in different ways. So I write it as rho, but other people put a rho zero, other people put rho h. It's just it's a matter of notation.
But if it's really the energy density rho, then h should just be 1 plus p over rho, shouldn't it? Because it should be rho plus p.
No, because I haven't told you. So I'm going to define the continuity equation to be rho ua. So what I write as rho, it's what I just don't want to keep writing a subindex 0.
Yeah, okay.
But it's just a matter of notation. So the equations of motions that determine the behavior of our fluid variables are the continuity equations, which is the divergence of rho u0, which we describe the RA as a conservation of matter in a given cell, baryonic matter in a given cell. And the divergence of stress energy tensor to 0. And so we're going to be after trying to solve for static stars in spherical symmetry as an exercise, and because it's one of the few things that we can actually do in closed form without too much effort. And we really don't need the code for that. But at the end of the day, we're going to have an equation to iterate, which is an ODE, which you can then go and just simply using Mathematic or Maple, iterate through in a very trivial form and build your own star that way. You can ask questions about, for a given value of density at the central region, what's the type of star you would get that way. So because of these conditions, spherical symmetry and staticity, we're going to have 3 Keeling fields, the 2 on the sphere plus the time field. We're going to choose a matrix or coordinates that take advantage of that symmetry. And the line element can then be written as some function b t square plus some function r square, sorry, square, the omega square, where we have chosen r to be an area radius. So r at any given constant, any given value, just measure the area of that sphere defined by the r equal constant. So these are choices we made. Remember last week in the example that Matt showed, and it's the one you're using for homework one, we added a shift vector so that things were regular across the horizon. We're here going to be worrying about stars. There's not going to be a horizon, so we're not going to have that problem unless you choose a star that has sufficient density in a small enough radius that you're going to form a black hole, in which case you're going to see the singularity, the coronary singularity showing up. So the stress energy tensor then, because of our assumption of staticity, this equation will be redundant. We're not going to have to worry about that. And I'm going to be using as my main variable this rho plus rho epsilon. So I can simply write TAB as rho hat plus p ua ub tab. And the fluid velocity of our fluid, or the forward velocity of our fluid, is just given by 1 and 0, but it has to be normalized, so it's proportional to 1, 0. But we're asking it to be normalized, satisfying ua equal minus 1. And therefore, you can show that the square root of p with zeros. So now is where you're going to do a little bit of work. You can simplify a lot of these things using Mathematica, or you can work them by hand, which is, in this case, is sufficiently simple. Einstein's equation, which can be written in one of these two ways. That's your typical equations where GAB is defined this way. You can also, by taking the trace, rewrite this in as RAB is equal to AP some R tensor SAB, where it's just a trace. You just trace reverse this equation. So as an exercise, I'm asking you to prove that you can rewrite these equations in that. It's just a very simple mathematical exercise. So I'm going to concentrate on this form of the equations. And then just in terms of everything we've written on that side, I'm just going to give you the equations that you'll get. And if I take prime to be the radial derivative, then the equations turns out to be and these are equations that you get by evaluating the different components of this equation, where the only relevant one will be the time-time component, the RR component, and the theta-theta components because the phi phi component is just going to be the theta-theta times sine squared theta, and all the off-diagonal terms are identically zero. So these are the equations that you get from Einstein's equations. We haven't yet said anything about the hydrodynamic equations themselves. So if you work those out, then you can prove that this equation implies actually a single equation, a single relevant equation. All the other ones are exactly the same, which just says b prime divided by b. So it's just a relationship on B's. And now this problem 2.1 just walks you through all the steps that are in here. So it's asking you to use these equations to end up with an equation that only involves A, because here you have equations with B double prime here and here. You can use these two. If I divide one by A and this one by B and this one by A, I can take the difference. I will knock off the B double prime. And then I can take these are equations to replace the part that has B prime. So you end up with an equation that only involves A prime.
So is that
rho hat? Rho hat, yes, thank you. Yes?
So are we trying to find the solution inside the star?
We're going to have the solution inside the star and outside. Because then we're going to have a matching condition outside the star where the density goes to zero. And outside, you have the solution. So when you put those things together, then the equation that you get for A is just given by R divided by A prime equal 1 minus A pi rho hat R square, which can be easily iterated to obtain something that we can write in very familiar terms. Where we have defined so we purposely split this a pi in 2 and 4 pi so that we can put this, and this is just for spherical symmetry, is the total amount of density iterated over a volume of spherical volume of radius r, so it's the mass contained within that sphere. And here we have 1 minus 2m over r, which of course is the same thing that you have in Schwarzschild's equations, which is what you would expect because we know that at from r out we should match smoothly to just the Schwarzschild line element.
But rho, we don't know rho already, do we?
No, we have to give a rho. We have to yet define an equation of state, but we're going to get everything together. But if we knew rho, then we could iterate this. So that's the second piece of information that we have yet to use, which is that this R equation coupled with an equation of state. And depending on the equation of state that we choose, you're going to be able to have more or less compact stars.
But you could write that equation as just, you know, an equation for M prime, you know, which you're going to integrate step by step along the other.
Right, but yes. So I'm getting there. We have yet to use that R equation as well.
Yeah, and in fact, if you go back to what we did last week, I mean, you can derive all this stuff from that general
yes.
Alpha squared is B.
It's B squared.
A is A squared. Right? And you can set all the time derivatives equal to zero and you'll get the same thing.
Yep.
And these would be called, there's Schwarzschild generalization, but polar slicing or maximal slicing.
the geometry.
Density for the scalar field, so it's better to keep it in that form so you can solve the nonlinear equation directly. So you should note that that special form, that really is a result of having these Schwarzschild-like coordinates.
Yes.
If you were in a different coordinate system, you wouldn't have a nice expression for this mass.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And, well, anyway, so last week, we, as I was saying earlier, we chose another set of coordinates where the line element looked different because now we had a shift. But anyway, so this is, if you want, the same situation that you saw with the scalar field, except that now instead of a scalar field, we're considering a perfect field. So the next step is we can combine that equation in here. And derive an equation that says which actually is a single equation if we add to this an equation of state. So we can add that equation of state, for instance, which we could replace either p or rho in here. Might as well replace p because rho is inside these m's. And this is just the equations for hydrostatic equilibrium in now general relativity. The difference is this term. So this is a new term that you wouldn't have if you weren't doing these things in GR. So you can try something like this or something like and just as an optional exercise, you can take this equation, replacing this, you might want to take another derivative so as to eliminate or have the equation in a simpler form. But this is just a simple ODE equation that you can iterate at the end of the day with Mathematica or Maple and get a nice solution. And you'll see the profile of the density that you would obtain having given a particular boundary condition, which would be the density you want at the origin. So this is just one particular simple example where you, at the end of the day, you have a static solution. Once you have it, you can play around different games. So Matt showed you last week in his colloquium the work by, I think it was Scott Noble, who was sitting here yesterday, where he took these stars and then just coupled the system to a scalar field and then just bounced on the star to see what is the dynamical behavior of both the stars, but most importantly of the space-time as a whole. So this is an iToy model if you want to have some interesting scenario where you can then go in and try to do some dynamics. Of course, if you want to do the dynamics, you actually have to incorporate or write down the full equations and then look at the dynamical behavior of the system. And what I want to do now is just walk you through at least the basic steps of trying to write down or recognize in these messy equations that we have at the end of the day, once you look at the continuity equations and the conservation of energy and momentum equations in the fully general relativistic case. And actually, we might even consider a more complicated scenario where not only fluids are playing a role, but also electromagnetic fields. So we're going to start in a general form, and then we're going to take different limits. So we're going to consider now that our situation is the following. So we have GR playing a role. We're going to have matter that is self-gravitating that will also be responsible for affecting the curvature and its own behavior. So we're going to consider fluid here. So we'll just put an F there. And we might also want to get in the mix some electromagnetic interaction as I said, if you want to even try to begin to understand phenomena like AGNs or GRBs, all these guys are playing an important role. The fluid description that we're going to choose is a very simplistic one, mainly because we don't really know how to do it better. People in nuclear physics, physicists are working hard at trying to come up with more richer equation states that will be applicable perhaps to the matter in very high energies, very high densities, but we don't really quite know that. And depending on the time scales that we're thinking about, those effects, the effects of the microphysics describing the fluid, might not play an important role. So it takes a while for the micro or the dynamics of the microphysics to actually have some significant effects on the dynamics. So for the most part, we're going to use this as our initial workhorse, and then later on, one might consider improving on some of those aspects. And I'll make some comments maybe at the end of the class on that. So let me just go through the basic derivation. Mainly what I'm trying to do is just make contact with the things that we have seen and how the situation looks in a more generic scenario. So we're going to consider the simplest possible case where the full stress energy tensor is simply the addition of the stress energy tensors describing the matter and the electromagnetic interactions. So this would be, if we write it in general, so this would be the stress energy tensor for given by the electromagnetic fields, where we have defined the electric field that an observer co-moving with the fluid that we will describe by the stress energy tensor of the fluid, will measure. And that's just given by the Faraday tensor contracted with the four velocity of the fluid. And the magnetic field measured by an observer co-moving with the fluid, so it's given by a similar definition, except that now we're acting with the dual of the Faraday tensor, where this defines us. Just take the dual of the Faraday tensor by just hitting with the Levi-Civita tensor, and that's how we define the magnetic field. And of course, the fluid is the one we have been using so far. Okay, so this is an awful mess. Doing it in general is really complicated. And in fact, for some of the systems that one might be interested, it might be an overkill. Because we're going to assume, for instance, if stars or plasmas have very high conductivity. If they do so, the electric field measured by a co-moving observer with the fluid will essentially be zero. So when we do that, all the E's drop out. And now we have a simpler stress energy tensor. So the full stress energy tensor, let me write it here is going to be given by this way. So the threshold tensor now simplified quite a bit. We have the contributions of the magnetic field. Again, remember the electric field at the frame of the fluid is considered to be zero. And so the first thing we notice here is this P entering in some role. So notice here and here. So in some sense, you could think of the BC up to or 1/2 b squared to be modifying the pressure. So this is seen as the contribution of the magnetic field energy to the pressure of the system. And in practice, you do see that this effect actually modifies the dynamics by adding this effective pressure. You see that depending on the strength of the magnetic field, the type of stars that you would get if you're looking for equilibrium solutions now with magnetic field will have different radius because of the role of the magnetic field. But that's not the only way it would come in. Again, as I said, I wanted to discuss things a little bit in general. So if you imagine that you're in a situation where the electromagnetic fields play absolutely no role, set the B to zero, and we're back to the stress energy tensor we discussed before. And so where I'm going to go as for a while, as general as I can, to try to distinguish situations where the magnetic fields do not play a role and those where it will. But at some point, I'm going to have to simplify the discussion. And we're going to assume that the magnetic field is zero. But for the moment, let me just keep as general as I can. And I want to make contact with something that you hear more. You have heard a little bit from Matt the first week, and you'll hear a lot more from Matt from Franz next week, which is this idea that you might have to be very careful the way you write the equations, and there is a lot of freedom due to the fact that we have constraints. Anyway, so now we have to tell what the equations of motions will be. So we knew what the equations of motion for the fluid part of the stress energy tensor would be. We're going to add to it the Faraday Maxwell's equations. That's the only one we have to care about because the electric field, as I said, in the frame of fluid is zero, so that's redundant. So we only one set of Maxwell's equations enter the problem. And this TAB, it's a full TAB. So this one will give us evolution equations for the magnetic field. This one, from this one, we have to extract evolution equations for our hydrodynamic variables. OK, so here is where we have to be careful. Remember what we said. We want, for all the reasons we've been discussing, to write the equations in conservation form. So whatever these equations tell us, we're going to have to try to group variables in such a way that we can write the things in conservation form.
Those are not, well, the equation for the
Bianchi identity, right? Well, the Bianchi identity will come in, say, in showing that if you have constraints being satisfied, the constraints will be propagated. So we're not going to explicitly use them. So in the code, we're going to put them in an implicit way, and that's, Franz, you're going to discuss that in the dynamic control of constraints. So we're going to use, so we're not going to explicitly enforce them. We're going to see what they tell us and how we might have to, or we might want to modify the equation so that if there is a violation, if the Bianchi equations are not exactly, Bianchi identities are not exactly being satisfied, that we try to drive it in such a way that they will be better satisfied as evolution proceeds. That will, we're going to use to keep control of the constraints. Here, I'm going to bring that up at some level, but not in a more pedestrian way than the one that is done for the Einstein's equations. So, okay, what we have here is the divergence of a vector and the divergence of a symmetric tensor. So we can use that fact to write or to realize what might be our conservative variables, the ones that we need to introduce to write things in conservation form. So remember this, the divergence of a tensor, of a vector is just simply here by this. So from there, we immediately, even without doing any particular 3 plus 1 decomposition, we realize that the time derivative of this equation will have as its own entity the variable square root of minus g rho ut. Right? So the time I have to, it's equal to 0, so I can ignore this square root of minus g, which is the determinant of the full metric. And here I have square root of minus g times rho times ut, the part that has the time derivative. So that we might want to define as its own variable, because that will now be having some flux form, because this will be 1 square root minus g dt square root minus g rho ut plus di square root minus g rho ui equals 0. So that is immediately in flux form, where our main variable, the first variable we introduce is that. And we give it a special name. We define it to be d is equal to that square root of minus g rho ut. And we would like to express things with respect to 3 plus 1 variables. So the determinant of the full matrix is equal to, and this is in Matt's notes, is equal to just the lapse times the determinant of the 3 metric, where I'm using gamma to describe the 3 intrinsic metric of the space-like hypersurfaces. Rho is the density, the Restmann's density. And ut, we discussed that yesterday, because we need to enforce the algebraic constraint ua equals minus 1. So if vi is the velocity, the 3 velocity of the fluid as measured in that space, in a space like hypersurfaces, then this is just simply 1 over square root of 1 minus v square, which is this thing we call w. Okay, so that one was the easy one. The complicated ones are the ones that come from there. And we're going to see immediately that we're going to have to give up the full conservation form, because we're going to have to have sources, simply because the divergence of a symmetric tensor will have Christoffel symbols showing up. So this, the second set of equations has a similar, simpler expression, but it has an extra term in the right-hand side. So that's equal to 0. So I can bring this part to the left, to the right-hand side, multiply with the minus square root of g. So let me just do that here. Say again? Yeah. This is, it's not the divergence of, it's not a divergence of a vector, it's a divergence of a tensor. Of a symmetric, and we use the fact that it's a symmetric tensor. Otherwise you have other terms in this.
Yeah. That's okay, but I think one of the intermediate steps you had in the wrong place.
Yes, yeah, that I erased it. Yeah, I cut it in the wrong place first. Remember, it is true, this is true. Right?
Okay.
But if you have a tensor, that's no longer the case. You have terms coming from the Christoffel.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. In fact, if it's symmetric, there's simpler, it's the simplest possible way, and this is the term that comes in. Now you have another exercise. Derive that for a generic symmetric tensor. Okay, so now you see that first we're going to have to deal with the fact that there is a right-hand side. So in our, say, if you implement this numerically, you're going to have to account for the characteristic structure, the flux conservation form, but also that now you have a source that will add or subtract energy, depending on what is it that you have. And also from here, you can read off what are the new conservative variables. So again, I can think of this in this form. TB equal whatever. So we have now four quantities coming from new conserved quantities from the TT and the TI. You had a question?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Actually, it was on the general stuff. This question is already done.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, when you use the polytropic equation for the equilibrium of the matter, don't you need to use the denominator of the equation? That it, they're in equilibrium with the gravitational potential.
Well, it's there, because we did everything in the GR, so the metric elements showed up. Well, at the end, we left that expression general, where we said, well, there is one equation, but there were two unknowns there. We had the P and the rho. So we had to eliminate one with the equation of state, and from there on, we have an ODE.
Oh,
that's
fixed. Okay.
Yes.
What's the polytropic?
It's an equation that says P is some constant. It's rho to another constant. And this one. That's an R1, rho times epsilon. So if there are no shocks in the problems, which we know generically will happen, but if you're in the cold case where things don't have like, rapid velocities or anything, where rho epsilon is similar to rho, then these two are give you exactly the same behavior. Once you develop these shocks or you have in a significantly dynamic scenario where this epsilon begins to play a role, then the solutions are different.
But for our case?
So for our case, we're going to be looking at the general case.
Oh, the general case. So it's not polytropic?
It's the ideal gas law.
Ideal.
Not the homework.
In the homework, we're using this, which is essentially the same as that one. So we're assuming that we're in the ultra-relativistic case and rho epsilon dominates over rho.
Okay.
And that rho epsilon will rebaptize with rho hat. Okay, so now let me just give you some general characteristics. As I said, you can see that very clearly things got really messy. So first, one of the conservative variables became this. The other conservative variables, which we'll read from here, the TT and the TIs, define the following relationship. Let's say, define within the downstairs, rho 1 plus epsilon plus p divided by rho w square vi. Where these names, E and S, do not come out of the blue. That's because it comes from the TT component, which is capturing the energy of the system, and this is capturing the momentum of the system. If you were to take the Newtonian limit of this, you will get exactly what you expect. Essentially, E is 1 mv squared, and the other one is mv. And finally, we have to add to it the equations for Maxwell's equations. If we were considering electromagnetic field interactions, and so this we need to add to it this one. Okay. So in the virtue of time, let me just say, so if you go to the notes, equations 36 through 40 have the 3 plus 1 decomposition in full gory details. If you were to want to actually implement that numerically. The other comment I want to make is that notice that this guy has a constraint associated to it, which is just a monopole constraint. So dB has to be 0. So I am free, even though the equations do not naturally give rise to that structure, to add anywhere I want here terms that have dB. So I'm going to, when you do this, you end up with, that's a constraint. That should be equal to 0. But I can add it to any of these terms in a judicial manner. So here, this is a, from here, I would have a vectorial equation when if I consider the dti, for instance. So I would be free to add something like bi, dj, bj. The reason, so I'm not doing anything as far at the analytical level. I'm simply adding a 0. But at the numeric level, the addition of terms like this in an appropriate manner can change the characteristics of the system in a weird way. The physical characteristics are still fine. We'll have exactly the same velocities, and we're not doing anything. But there's some coordinate characteristics, some things that refer to the gauge choice that we have adopted. Those we can change in this way. But more importantly, if we define the constraint C to be, say, di, bi, and we ask how the constraint will be propagated in time, the addition of terms like this can change that equation. And Franz will show next week how we do that very explicitly in Einstein's equations to very much affect what the behavior of the equations, the constraints would be.
So di was the spatial?
The spatial derivative. And bi would be, it's related to this little b. So we can get into these details. It's just proportional to the rb. But it's essentially this bi would be the magnetic field that an observer, the natural observer on the space that is normal to the space-like hypersurface will measure the magnetic field to be.
Oh, OK. I got confused. I was thinking the bi from the metric.
No. This is the. So let me just parenthetically say this. You know that Maxwell's equations, curl B and B dot is curl dot A. I have the minus sign in the right. I never remember. One is dual from the R. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so here, if you use these equations and you define the constraint to be, say, di bi, which is monopole constraint, you take the time derivative of that in here, which then will say di b dot I, and I replace this by the curl of E, then I have the divergence of a curl, which is 0, and then we would conclude that C dot is equal to 0. But as a simple exercise, if you want, think, see what would happen if I were to modify the Maxwell's equations in this way. Say we are in, we have no sources, no charges, and no current. So I didn't do anything. The vectorial character of the equation is the same. I added a zero here and a zero there. If I ask the same question, what does the constraint do in time if we're evolving the fields with these new equations, then this behavior will be completely changed. And this is some of the games we actually play to try to make sure that the constraints in time are well behaved.
Can you just add any terms you want, even if they violate the parity?
You can, right, you have to be careful. I can add any terms I want, but I could do it in such a way that you end up messing completely the nice hyperbolic character of the equations. So I could do it in the wrong way. So an example would be, yeah, I can add zero, but let me put an I here times E. Of course, that is nonsense. But if you do things like that, I mean, of course, this would be badly behaved afterwards. So you have to be careful that the characteristic structure you end up at the end of the day is sensible. But you can use that to your advantage. And this one has to do here. Let me just mention a few more things and we'll quit. So once you write the 3 plus 1 decomposition, remember what were the next steps. They were the next natural steps if you want to implement this, was to try to understand the characteristics of the system. The characteristics of these systems are a Royal mess. For the full equations, including the magnetic fields, they are not known. We know the velocity, the characteristic speeds, but we do not know all the characteristics, the eigenvectors. So this is a very non-trivial work that people are working on this. And the Newtonian and the ultra-relativistic, in the relativistic case, they are known, but not in the general relativistic case. But luckily there are solvers out there. One of them is the HLLE solver that you might, if you read papers, it comes out all the time, where you don't need to know the full characteristic structure of the system, just the main velocity suffices to end up with a system where we have the right capture of velocity of shock speeds. It will do the right job at discontinuities. It's not crazily, or it's not as accurate as the Rho solver, but it gets the job done when you don't have the full information. If you were to look at what the characteristics of these systems, the velocity of these systems are for no magnetic, for the magnetic field being zero, you would find the following. Let me just write this and we're done. So we have, if we have only these equations, because we're setting the magnetic fields to zero, we have five equations to deal with, four coming from here and one coming from here. We expect to have five characteristic speeds. And these are given by three, have exactly this value.
Sorry, that's dotted into what?
Yeah, I have to, the Vn.
Dotted into the normal?
Vn is Vi dotted into any normal direction that you care to look at. If you're looking at the x direction, the y direction, the z direction, or any other arbitrary direction, this is what I define by Bn. And here, gamma nn is a component of the contravariant 3 matrix in that direction as well. So we have three eigenvalues which are exactly the same. And this is, again, something that we discussed earlier in the week. Luckily, even though the eigenvalues are exactly the same, that the matrix is diagonalizable. So as far as the hyperbolicity of the system, this system is very nicely hyperbolic. So we have three velocities, characteristic velocities given by this, and two, the plus and minus, given by this mess, where the local speed of sound in the fluid shows up. This is something that you probably are not familiar at all with, but if you take the Newtonian limit of this one will be the lambda zeros turned up just to be the velocity of the fluid, so perturbations will just be dragged along with the fluid. And the lambda plus minus is simply the velocity of fluid plus minus the sound speed. So perturbations either get dragged with the fluid, or they modify the fluid velocity with just the local sound speed.
So what were alpha and beta again?
Alpha, the lapse and the shift. And this is, remember, this is a coordinate choice. We could have chosen a lapse and shift, so the lapse phase one and the shift is zero, so this one just gives you that one. If instead of this we actually were to turn on the magnetic field, these velocities get complicated. They change according to the strength of the magnetic field. But as a discussion there I put in the text, you might wonder, well, what happened with the speed of light? I knew the Maxwell equations are describe propagation of the speed of light. This is completely gone in here. We don't have propagation of the speed of light for the magnetic modes in the fluid. And the reason is we took a very special limit. So there is a discussion there, which is simply added there because this is an subject that the first time I saw this ideal MHD equation, I got completely confused. Where did the C go? And it's kind of in lengthy ways described there. So let's stop here. We're going to reconvene tomorrow. We're going to say a few things on this front, but mostly what we want you guys to do is we might go upstairs and push on the homework.
So essentially, Google stuff from the lecture and then do upstairs.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see how it goes. We want to first know how far along you guys are, and if we have to sacrifice, well, describing some of these higher level things that are written in the notes, we'll do that. We'd rather have you guys understand.